Tonight, we're going to talk about destruction and creativity. What's the relationship between these two things? How are they connected? Is there a relationship? And if so, how does that impact how we're creative and what it means to be creative? I want to frame that both within the story of the universe as well as within our own sort of experience. So to begin, I'd like you to think about a time in your life when you felt creative, when you felt very creative. Sometime, some portion of your life when it felt like you were very creative. Just bring that time to mind. Okay, with that time in mind, think about what was required for your creativity at that time. What was required to allow that time of creativity? What was the situation? What were the elements involved that were required to allow you to have that time of creativity? Okay. And just with one other person, just kind of touch base about that. See what, if you want to describe the situation, go ahead. If you just want to talk about what you felt was required in that situation to bring forth your creativity. So just talk to someone else, find out what they thought about that.
The thing I thought of when you mentioned it. In your case, you can
solve a problem that's been very creative and sort of engineering. So. You did that, didn't you?
Later, he offered me a job.
It doesn't have to be on your talent.
He was kind of surprised. Thought we happened. But I had more training.
Finish up your thought about your lunch.
Between Los Angeles
and anything kind of. Anything specific come out of that you'd want to put up here? Requirements for your creativity?
To me, you've got to be interested in what this is. You have some either burning desire, whatever. You want to solve a problem, or just as something that's always been of interest to you, or whatever.
So
that motivates you to.
Motivation, right, for moving that. So there's a sense in which you need this in order to have a certain energy.
To keep going.
To keep going.
To work long hours or whatever you need to do.
That's really nasty.
Everybody tonight.
That's good.
Yeah, great, thank you. Other requirements that you noticed?
Preparation.
Could you speak a little bit about that?
Well, it's preparation, but also a stress, in the case I was thinking of, in which I really had either forgotten or I hadn't reviewed. And so I was prepared, but at the time I was doing it, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm not as prepared as I thought I was. Uh-huh. But I was. And so there was a stress or anxiety that kind of heightened.
Maybe a resistance. Yeah. Yeah, sort of. That there's, what's this energy requirement, this energy for creativity, and you need some motivation to get over that, to get through that. In a chemical system, we call that activation energy, to get a reaction going, but also a sense in which the ground has to be ready for that creativity. It has to be prepared in order to overcome some of that anxiety or stress. There's also a sense in which sometimes stress can be a motivator or a facilitate creativity. We'll talk some more about that too. Any other things?
Imagination.
Okay, opportunity and imagination. Yeah.
And time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, excellent. And all those requirements. Anyone see happening in moments of creativity things that were the groundwork that was sort of laid by someone else, by other people or other events that you didn't really do, you didn't have a hand in, but it enabled this creativity to take place? Have a sense of that in discussion. In my reflection on my own times when creativity, when I felt most creative, at times there was a sense in which a lot of the work had been done, or that preparation had been, someone had gone before me, or something had gone before me to prepare that. So.
Could it be, I was thinking of another time mm-hmm. in which you were part of a team. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that you weren't alone, but we were, as a team, actually it was a choir,
right.
as a group.
As a group,
did something special about
that. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Well, the opportunity can arise when a lot of people are abandoning something.
Right, so the opportunity coming out of
chaos.
The chaos, yeah, or maybe waste. Mm-hmm. That those can be moments of creativity. Yeah, great. There's a point in the development of the Earth system where this is particularly interesting, when the bacteria had were eating the sun, basically, by catching photons and turning those photons into energy and using water. Using hydrogen from that and releasing oxygen into the atmosphere in that process. And that oxygen was building up in the atmosphere. There were no oxygen breathing plants or animals at that time. And so there's this, the next time, oxygen was this waste product. It was like plastic milk jugs, you know, just piled all over the place. And it just kept getting higher and higher. Out of that waste came this opportunity for creativity. And the first eukaryote cell made use of that oxygen instead of just kind of living with it. It made use of that oxygen, developed a way of breathing that oxygen, turning the potential, the creativity inherent in that oxygen into a reality. So that's a point where, in the Earth cycle, where you see waste becoming an opportunity for creativity. I want to touch a little more on the story, our origin story, and highlight some of these ideas from our own experiences of creativity with a story, part of our story, the creation, our creation story here, out of a book called The Universe Story, a book by Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. This is a book I've been using throughout this sequence. And it's a book that re-images the scientific story of creation as a story. So it takes what we understand about the way we've come to be here and uses that information to tell a story of creation. The story format is new to a scientific understanding in some ways. It's a new expression of that. And in some ways it's been avoided by the scientific enterprise because to talk about story is to open the door to meaning and to open the door to mystery. And within the scientific enterprise, within understanding of science, meaning and mystery are always woven in there. They're always underneath there. I mean, whenever you ask a question in science, there's always the corresponding question of why. Why does that happen? Whenever you ask a question or come up with an answer through science, there's always another question you can ask. A deeper question. So we say that gravity forms this bonded relationship between the Earth and the Sun. Why? Why does that? Why does gravity form a bonded relationship between mass? And the answer is mystery. We don't know. We don't know why. So there's always been those two elements, meaning and mystery, within the story that does. Science has uncovered for us, but to retell our understanding in terms of story makes those more apparent, makes those clear. It doesn't sort of whitewash those. It says we come out of deep mystery. We at the root of our story is meaning, and to tell it as a story is to open the doors for that. I think Swim and Berry do a nice job of opening those doors without saying, this is what it means. This is what you have to believe. This is what, these are the why questions. They pose those questions. And like any good story, you come away with the story with your own experiences and try to understand what the meaning is. So let me tell you part of this story about destruction and loss, destruction and creativity. This part of the story focuses on the supernova that gave birth to the elements forming our solar system. So, In the fireball, the initial moments of creativity in the universe, all that was created was hydrogen and helium. Hydrogen and helium were all that were created. A tremendous act of creativity. Before that, there was never anything like hydrogen or helium in the universe. But things like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all those things that we depend on for life on the Earth were not created in the fireball. They weren't there at the beginning of the universe. It was only through the creativity of the first stars that these elements came into existence. So this is the story of that. The story that talks about the preparation that was needed for the creation of the earth. In the beginning, the universe is a great shining that expands rapidly and then explodes into hundreds of billions of dark clouds. In the ensuing epoch of night, matter gathers into vast cellular regions in response to the preternatural music filling the universe. These great clouds then collapse upon themselves, each one becoming millions of times smaller. In this way, one by one, and then, almost simultaneously, 100 billion galaxies light up with a splendor new to the universe. The beginning of the universe is a smooth, intense flame. A few billion years later, the large-scale structure of the universe glows in great sheets of galaxies, and in their intersections in long, spidery filaments. The story of the universe is a story of majesty and beauty, as well as violence and disruption. A drama filled with both elegance and ruin. A billion years after the birth of the universe, when the galaxies have just emerged, great regions of hydrogen and helium drift about the center of the Milky Way. In the collapse of our galactic cloud, the spinning of the matter flattens out disc-like. As the angular rotation carries the clouds into the gentle movements of the twirling spiral galaxy. After another 100 million years, the invisible density arm sweeps through the cloud and shocks it into collapsing upon itself. No further energy is required from the galaxy. The cloud that has drifted undisturbed for eons suddenly undergoes a profound transformation that destroys its basic form, but gives birth to a cluster of 10,000 diamond lights in a sea of dark night. After its powers are activated by the density wave, the cloud reassembles its materials via gravitational intensities that fracture the cloud into hundreds and thousands of self-imploding centers, the first stars. In each of these stars, hydrogen and helium atoms are drawn together by their mutual attraction. As they collide and interact with each other, the friction creates even higher temperatures. Their materials continue to concentrate. Eventually, the heat reaches temperatures beyond the endurance of the atoms. Every atom is destroyed in the intensity of the implosion. Each of the self-imploding centers, the collapse continues until the pressure generated by the heat initiates the burning of nuclear fuel. Millions of tons of matter are now transferred into energy each second. As every star collapses, hydrogen atoms turn into protons, then transfigure these into helium nuclei. As the hydrogen is used up in the nuclear burning, the star turns to the helium to continue its existence. So long as the star has helium to transform into carbon, it can sustain itself against the crushing pressures of gravity. As the helium is used up, though, the star turns to carbon and other higher order nuclei to stave off its final self-implosion. Eventually, in a million years or in several billion years, depending on the star. Each star's resources against the collapse are used up. If the mass of a star at this point is large enough, its gravitational pressures will destroy the star. The remaining material will rush toward each other, and nothing in the universe can now stop them. All the remaining structure is destroyed as the star implodes down to a pulsar, a super dense mass of neutrons, or collapses all the way down to a not entity, a singularity of space-time, a black hole. This stellar being that burned brightly for billions of years, that may have showered sentient creatures with radiant energy, that those creatures transformed into their living bodies and into cathedrals that rose in wheat fields, has gone. Only a black cinder is left. And yet, in the great violent collapse of the star, there is a surprising twist of events, a supernova. Not everything is pulled into the nothingness of the pulsar or the black hole. The neutrinos, those wispy and seemingly unimportant elementary particles, escape the collapse. As the star implodes, the neutrinos rush out in all directions and blow off the outer layers of the star, which contain carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, helium, molybdenum, and the other elements. Freed from the gravitational death of the star, these elements journey into the night sky, eventually to be drawn together with other elements. Under their own attraction, they form an entirely new system. A new star forms, new planets form, new life forms, and perhaps new consciousness forms. Certainly a new area of the story of the universe begins out of the supernova explosion that destroys the old stellar world. Part of the story then of the creativity of the universe, part of the way that the creativity of the universe is shown, part of the preparation laid billions of years ago for our own creativity today comes out of this great destruction. It comes out of this, what must seem like a terrible event. I mean, imagine if you are this star, right? If this star had consciousness, and it's using up its resources. It's used up its hydrogen, and so it uses the helium. It's used up the helium, then it uses the carbon. But finally, it runs out of everything it can, all of its resources that it can use to maintain its life. Right? Would it want to die? Would it want to pass and never exist again? But in that sacrificial offering, in that explosion of material, is the only thing that can enable our life to exist. Our existence now is a direct result of that. The elements in your body, in the chair, in this building, I mean, this stuff here is the stuff from a star. We are made of star stuff. We are the stuff of stars. There's nothing that we see on the earth that didn't come out of those stars, those primordial stars. Out of the destruction of those stars. Not just those stars sort of giving us their excess, but giving us the very essence, the very what was very necessary for their existence, sacrificing their existence. Okay. So with this, with these elements in mind, I'd like to outline three areas of three parts of this story, and that came out in the stories that we spoke of our understanding of how, why is there this destruction? Why does it seem like this destruction takes place? And why might it be needed for creativity? The first one is really kind of within this idea. Resistance, stress, understood as in many ways, it has many levels sort of folded into the story. On a fundamental level, in the supernova, the atoms that are being crushed together under gravitational pressure can resist that. An understanding or a way of talking about this in from the scientific understanding is called the exclusion principle, that no two particles can exist in the same state in the same place. Okay, so as gravity pulls these elements of these protons together, they resist that. They resist being crushed. There's a sense in which the proton says, no, I want to be a proton. You can't crush me. You can't throw me out of existence. I want to exist. Okay? This chair that holds you up, its existence says, no, you can't just walk through me. You can't just put your hand through me. I want to exist as a chair. Right? It resists your movement, luckily, or else we'd all be sitting on the floor right now. And it's out of that resistance that this creativity comes. If the protons could just come together and just sort of pass right through each other, there'd be no stars. We wouldn't be here. Right? So there's a sense in which that resistance is imperative for the creativity of stars. Let me give you another example. Understanding of evolutionary biology, it's stress and resistance that's the inspiration, if you will, for creativity. It's out of stress and resistance that creativity happens. If, for example, an eagle could just think, I'm hungry and I want a rabbit. And that rabbit just appeared in front of the eagle, and all the eagle had to do was just sort of open its mouth, let this rabbit sort of slide in. Didn't have to do anything, no resistance to its movement. The eagle would not exist in the way we know it. I mean, it wouldn't have to fly. It wouldn't have to have keen eyesight. It wouldn't have to have the strength, the beauty of form that we think about when we think of an eagle. It's only the resistance of the rabbit that enables the eagle to truly be creative. The creativity that brought forth an eagle is out of the resistance, that stress, that tension, creative tension, sometimes called, that brings forth that creativity. So let me put these up here. One is it's often called Pauli's exclusion principle. And I'll maybe just list the other as creative tension. Okay, the second one is this energy requirement. As you were thinking about what was required for creativity in your own experiences, one thing that came up was an idea that, boy, it takes work that you need to have some motivation for creativity, because there's a work, there's an energy that's required to be creative. And that energy requirement is, again, has many levels. Within the scientific story, we can understand, we speak of this as the second law of thermodynamics. This is an observation that basically just that. All creativity has an energy requirement. Something, you don't get something for nothing.
Okay.
In the star, in the story of the primordial star, as it's imploding, it must use up the hydrogen in order to exist. The creativity of the star, how it's organized, it's the energy that it's able to produce, all of that comes from this requirement of hydrogen. Right? Now think about it. Hydrogen has been around since the beginning of the universe. And every second, 4 million tons of hydrogen is being funneled into our sun. It's being used up. It's just gone. Right now, it's gone. There's another 4 million tons. Gone. 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 That hydrogen that has existed for 15 billion years, gone. It's just gone. Because the sun requires that. Our creativity on the earth requires that energy. The energy in that hydrogen. And the last one, the last thread I want to draw out of this is kind of in this one, imagination. Anxiety. This imagination. Our scientific understanding of this idea, the word that's kind of comes up for that is sort of a strange one. It's autopoiesis. Autopoiesis. But imagination is a good equivalent to it. It's another way of saying it is self-organization. That the star, as this hydrogen gas is just floating out of there, out there in space, and it gets shocked by the galaxy. The current understanding is that this, in our spiral galaxy, there's a density arm. An area that's of greater has a bit greater gravitational event happening, and this arm sort of swings through the galaxy at around every 100 million years. The arm passes through the galaxy. And as this arm swung through where this great mass of this hydrogen cloud was sort of just floating peacefully, it shocked it. It shook it up. It gave it a little shake. And after that little shake, the hydrogen began collapsing together, forming this this star. All it needed was that little bit of shake, that little shaking, to get it going. And once it started moving, once it started going, the hydrogen, in a sense, knew what to do. The hydrogen, in that sense, could imagine a star. It had the insight of a star. It had its own self-organizing dynamic, its own autopoietic activity that could bring itself together to form a star. I think a this one needs a little bit of manipulatives to help understand it. And this is one that I like a lot. There's nothing magic about this little green piece here. Let me just present that for your inspection. No batteries, no veins, it's just a little hole.
No rabbits.
No rabbits. No hydrogen there.
No supernovae.
Just a little reducing hole there. And the water in this bottle knows what to do in this situation. So I take this water in here, just sort of peacefully sitting there, but with a great potential. The energy is there in this water, and I give it a little shock, and it forms its own, under its own understanding, its own self-organizing dynamic, it forms a whirlpool. So there's a way that the water imagines the whirlpool. So we'll let you, you have to give it that little bit of start, a little shock to get it going. But after it gets going, there's no more, I don't have to tell it any more than that. Right? I don't have to give it any more instructions on it. It knows what to do.
And the air goes up through the center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, our best understanding of this kind of idea at this point is through something called systems theory that tries to talk about the way that systems behave as a whole, as a unit. How they, a system will have its own self-organizing dynamic, its own understanding on some level. I mean, it's not understanding as we understand things, but on some level that water understands what it needs to do in reaction to this system. Okay. So that's imagination, and maybe we'll just put opportunity down here at the bottom.
That very same phenomenon happens every time you use the sink and the toilet.
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. It's that same situation going on there. This is just in a test tube, so to speak. In a quantum understanding, this self-organizing dynamic is talked about as quantum tendencies or potentialities that basic level we can't say what will happen, we can say what tendency things have to happen. So this is somehow woven deeply within our understanding of the universe. Tendencies to happen. Okay, so these three elements, or maybe these four elements here, are kind of a structure, an outline, a way of thinking about why creativity needs destruction, or how destruction and creativity are connected, related. I will share with you that in my own struggle with this, it's still a struggle. I'm still trying to understand this in my own experience and from my own life. Why does creativity need this destruction? Why are these so intimately related? But it's our experience of the universe, our observation that the universe that we live in is like this. This is the way that the universe is. Could it have been different? We don't know. We don't know. But this is the universe that we find ourselves a part in. What reflections or questions kind of come out of that? Yeah, Megan. Yeah, great.
I'm wondering if the same is true of people, I mean, in terms of our collective unconscious. All this destruction is going on around us in our, in, you know, wherever, it doesn't matter which part of the world you're from or what culture you belong mm-hmm. to. And I'm wondering if that's not a signal that something is going to happen in within the collective unconscious or consciousness of us as objects that's going to begin to recreate the way we live.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not. I mean, right. maybe we won't live, we'll come back as dust or something, I don't know. But it seems to me that with, I mean, I've spoken with lots of people and read some books, and I mean, there seems to be this really up from the bottom sort of sense that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is just cool.
Yeah, John,
you
have a response to that?
When I look at these up here, simplistic take on it will be the reason for the destruction is because of the second doctrine of dynamics. In order to do the self-organization, in order to do the mm-hmm. creation, you're running against the law, so to speak. You can do that. You can create order out of the chaos by consuming the energy in the process. And so to maintain that requires that energy level. Your description of the sun, once it's lost its hydrogen fuel, there's a number of ways it can go depending on the size mm-hmm. of the sun. It can either shrink down, become a white dwarf, burn out eventually, or go supernova or whatnot. In the same way with ourselves, we consume the oxygen we need to eat, and when our mm-hmm. systems finally run down, we are no longer kind of temporarily fighting the second law of thermodynamics. We return back to the essence of which we are.
Yeah.
To recreate something new in nature.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting meditation that sometimes I find useful in my own experience, is to think to think about in my own death what will be created out of that. Yeah.
Are you suggesting that we shouldn't be concerned then about the destruction?
Yeah,
that work?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that there is a way in which
part of some kind of natural process.
I think there's a way in which some destruction is creative and some destruction is just wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my own sort of experience of it. That there's some destruction that does not lead to creativity. And the tribal peoples had a way of talking about this, which I mentioned the last time, that I think is just fascinating, and it's an interesting perspective that some of the primal cultures, the first cultures, the understanding was that our job in life was to become the food of God. That things are destroyed because God has a need, because God needs that. And that our work here, our creativity, was about becoming interesting food. Becoming food that was worthy of being consumed. And the other side of that, another way of saying that, was that evil things, evil people, destruction that was just a waste, was not consumed. It just disappeared. It didn't become something new. It wasn't used for the continuation of the process, deepening of the adventure. It was just lost. It was just wasted. So my own sense is that distinction between destruction that is necessary and destruction that seems just wasteful. And maybe that's just a limitation on my perspective, that I can only see sort of a certain level. But I think there is, I think it's a deep understanding of it, going back a long time, that there are some situations that are not redeemed, if you will. Yeah, Teek?
This just kind of came to me. I'm not sure, but it seems to me that, well, for one thing, in the destruction, there's a tremendous amount of pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And our children, their children, you know, et cetera, are going to have a miserable life if we don't do something. And I believe that there is a choice that happens. I don't know how this works on, you know, the thermodynamic level and these other things, but I'm sure we can come up with ways that there is a creativity without that. And part of it is by the learning before we get there and saying, well, at least as human beings, I think, that if we do this, this is going to happen, so, you know, and then this will result, and then eventually we'll get to where we have to do things differently after we've gone through the catharsis, the pain, the crisis, and that is how things usually work.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we have learned from history that we never learn anything from history, you know? And so there's a possibility here that maybe, I mean, it'd be kind of nice, just for a change, we'd say, you know, we don't just learn facts in history class for one thing. We learn cause and effect stuff in history class for a change. And then we go, oh yeah, we're headed there again. And say, let's avoid the crisis this time and go right to the healing. And I think that there can be just this tremendous hundred monkey kind of thing that, you know, I mean, it seems like an insurmountable task,
mm-hmm.
trying to deal with these huge, very rich corporations and people that are out there that are just in this absolute insanity. They're not happy either. They're just power seems to make them feel good. They think they're okay.
Yeah.
Illusion. The recent questions that have come up seem to be another axis, so to speak. Because rightly or wrongly, what you've presented so far is a description, a beautiful description of the way our universe came into being and how it exists and our place in it. But missing from all that, along another axis, so to speak, is these value systems that we're starting to bring up. So the destruction, I've read accounts of the epitome of destruction is the battlefront. You hear accounts of Verdun, you hear accounts of the Russian front, consumed literally millions of men,
mm-hmm.
consumed incredible quantities of fuel and resources. And people just had a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
It just mm-hmm. ravaged across the countryside.
Mm-hmm. Sort of its own autopoietic system, organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then on the other hand, there's the destruction of someone that shoots a deer for food for the winter. So there's another loss of life, so to speak. There's obviously a very different value system associated with that. Then there's common sense. If you see that a bunch of rocks are coming down off the mountain, there's a lot of potential for destruction there. Jump out of the way.
You're very hopeful. You can run fast enough.
What this says to me, though, is that there's a way in which loss and destruction are on some level necessary in a creative life, in my life. That to deny that I will die, to deny that tension that's set up by realizing that I'm going to die, and no matter how many hospitals we build, I'm going to die. And that no matter what the healthcare system is, I'm going to die. To deny that or to avoid that removes that tension, removes that resistance, and I can just kind of fritter my life away.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But to pay attention to that, to somehow embrace that or engage that sense of loss that's going to happen. I mean, I don't want to die, but I'm going to die. That's the way the universe is. I will die. And so to pay attention to that dynamic is a way of drawing out creativity in my life. This, I think, is also captured in our own Christian understanding, with the whole understanding of death and resurrection, that it's only through the cross, through the death of Jesus, that resurrection was able to take place. That it was somehow this event that in a mysterious way, in a way that we don't understand, leads to new life. A new life. So what this calls me to is not in a sense to, as you were saying, of saying, well, I don't have to worry about the destruction in the world because it's all going to sort of work out to greater creativity, but to rather to pay attention to areas where there is loss, where that loss isn't a creative dynamic in my life, and to make use of that energy for creativity, to try to become interesting food so that I will be consumed by the universe and that I won't just pass away. But in our culture spends an intense amount of energy in denying that completely, mm-hmm. in saying, no, everything can pass away except this. Mm-hmm. You know? Okay, so maybe I will die, but my family is not going to die. You know, my family's not going to die. They're going to go on. Or my nation is not going to die. This company is not going to die. And so this whole energy going into avoiding diverting our understanding of that that tension that's set up, that resistance that's set up, that seems to me a real pathology, a real missing of possibility there. I mean, what would we do as a nation if we knew that we were going to die as a nation? If the United States only has a certain amount of time, instead of thinking about how can we keep our life as a nation, because we know we're going to die. We know it. If we really knew that, if we, on a deep level knew that, we could take all that energy and think about, well, what could we give to the dynamic? What could we give to the unfolding story of the earth? What would be our great gift of the United States had to offer? And turn our energy into that creativity. Other thoughts or questions, perspectives on that? Reflections from your own life about death and resurrection and your own experience?
Well, the destruction and creation of our own cells as we, first of all, just the molecular structure, we're doing that all the time. Mm-hmm. And then our personalities, we're constantly changing. And, I am not the person who was 10, 20 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be. So part of creativity is growth. And that destruction is necessary for the
right.
growth.
Yeah. Yeah, on both the cellular level, a material, very material level, and a psychic level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To say nothing of emotional.
Right?
And spiritual. We all grow yeah. spiritual.
Well, thank you for coming out then, and it's been a
I do have another question.
Oh, sure.
I didn't know if it was pertinent enough to this class, so I didn't believe it. But there are three things. Like, do you think there's life elsewhere? What do you think about UFOs? And you had said something about life able to occur only at one point.
Mm-hmm.
One point.
Mm-hmm. On the Earth.
On Earth, okay.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Was, okay. And so, okay, would you answer the first two then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just to clarify the last one, the current understanding in in evolutionary biology is that if life were to disappear from the Earth now, it would not reemerge on the Earth. That the conditions that led to the emergence of life are no longer a part of the Earth. So that in some sense, that the time for the creativity of life on the Earth has passed. Then the first question about life elsewhere. It seems to me that when the universe, within the universe, when galaxies came into being, it wasn't one galaxy. Mm-hmm. It was billions of galaxies. When the time for the creation of galaxies was ready, there was tremendous energy for the creation of galaxies. When the time for stars, to create stars came, a tremendous energy for creating stars. And so just out of that, out of our experience of the universe, that the universe doesn't ever seem, there's never seems to be a dynamic in the universe for doing things in sort of a small way. I mean, it's always just, just let's have a party and just make millions of these things. That my sense is that life is a similar dynamic. That the creation of life is probably not restricted to the Earth.
And in an intelligence
level? Intelligence, again, I think there's a sense in which
that same predetermination.
That same movement happens. Now, whether we're sort of at the beginning of that, or whether we're kind of in the middle of that, maybe we're on the Earth is the first of many, And if so, what sort of a responsibility we have then to, set an example? Yeah.
Just within the past couple of weeks, some of the news there was. Information about we being the descendants of Martians.
Hmm.
Have you come across that?
No, I haven't.
That they're by examining some of the meteors that have hit the Earth, they've discovered that.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. That they found in some meteor that's been. Shown to, or that they understand to have come from Mars, they found organic carbon compounds. Yeah, I did see. So not so much descended from Martians, but that the stuff that enabled life or facilitated the development of life was also present on Mars at one time. And maybe was transferred from Mars to the Earth. Yeah. It wouldn't have been like there would have been a little bacteria on a meteor that made it to the Earth. Bacteria could never survive the intense heat in an impact with the Earth. But the stuff that makes up some of the carbon elements, organic carbon, could have. Been a part of that. Now, it's not as unusual as it may be sort of made out in some of these articles. I mean, we have found similar carbon compounds in comets and meteors and in most places that we look in the universe that we can detect for some of this carbon, these carbon compounds. We tend to find it. There.
Meaning that there was organic life that produced it in that form?
No, that that somehow that stuff
is needed
in lots of places in the universe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you need conditions that are right. You need this these opportunities for this self-organizing dynamic to take over. It's thought that there may have been at one time life on Mars, but that's a speculative perspective. We've never discovered evidence for that.
We have to run, so.
Yeah, oh, I think we all do. So thank you very much for coming out.